If you're like me, keeping up with the news has become a real pain. All the best news sites are locked behind paywalls, and the free stuff is just clickbait that no one should waste time on. Imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and clickbait, but still shows you every story from multiple perspectives to counter bias, where good news, as in positive stories, is highlighted so you don't become despondent, and where journalists dig through news from around the world to find stories you wouldn't normally see. That's what an innovative Australian startup called Inkl, I-N-K-L, has come up with. Inkl.com has signed partnerships with 100 plus news sources like The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, creating a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best of newsfeed. The service unlocks more than $12,000 of premium news for $100 a year. If you go now to inkl.com/hardy, they'll give you an additional 25% discount, so you can get a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. That's inkl.com/hardy, inkl.com/hardy.
Hello and welcome to the Hardy Report. My name's Edward Hardy, and for today's interview, I'm joined by Chip Franklin, radio host on KGO Radio, a comedian, a musician, and if you're an ardent user of Twitter like myself, then you'll probably recognize him through his regular coverage of current affairs as a host for Really American or on Inside the Beltway, his videos on social media that often blow up and go viral. Chip Franklin, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Edward. Good to be here. I'm flattered. Thanks.
Let's start for a bit of intro for people who might not be familiar with you. How did you get into this? Because as I say, you're a talk show host, you're a comedian, musician. Obviously, politics probably plays into being a talk show host covering current affairs. But what made you say, I'm going to go out there and do these videos on such a regular basis?
Oh, the videos I've been doing. I was like a mini filmmaker back in the 90s, back when it was hard, before Final Cut and Premiere and, you know, allowed us to just, you know, before digital, back in the day when you shot film, it would cost about $1,000 a minute to process, you know, so you had to be judicious about what you shot and, you know, and you really had to be ready. And of course, that's the thing about guerrilla filmmaking today, you know, you can just point and click, but you still essentially, on an editing table, you have to decide what is the final product. It all comes down to editing. So you take a huge step back, and this applies to everything we do in life, really, is the planning and preparation of what you want to say, you know, the arc of your story, you know. Anyway, yeah, so I kind of got into the video thing with probably back in about 15 years ago, and started posting, but long before Twitter and Facebook really blew up, you know. And it's interesting, too, to see, you know, I'll have some videos that Twitter now will censor, or they'll tell people it's sensitive material when it's not, but it's just an algorithm. You know, we've heard of all these algorithms and what we're dealing with. So probably, you know, I mean, my videos can get like 100,000 views or 1.5 million. And it's crazy, too, because the pushback and feedback from people, everything from threats to, you know, celebrities following you, which is cool. And it's a rush. Right. But, you know, I mean, this is cool, too, talking to somebody on the other side of the world. Right. It's fun. Especially if you sense people share some common, you know, perceptions. And that's what's great about these videos is there's no ambiguity. Right. I mean, it's pretty straight up. You know how I feel about something. So to answer a long answer to that is because I had a radio show, I started them to kind of promote the radio show. But then the parent company thought they were a little too much. At one point, I called Devin Nunes, a congressman from California. I called him a fuck knuckle. And apparently it got back to his people and they complained to my parent company, which owns like 900 radio stations. Cumulus is the company. And they said, hey, ease it back, dude. Okay, just a little bit. So, yeah, so you can actually see them today. And I won't say the F-bomb, but I might use celebrity clips from movies where somebody might say it. But the bottom line is, it's like, you know, like yesterday's was just simply about why aren't we enforcing these subpoenas, which is an old English word for, you know, making someone appear right in court. And why aren't we enforcing these on these people that assisted in the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol? Anyway, so that's, yeah, so it's, the videos are, they're fun because I have total control. When I'm doing a radio show for 3 hours, I'm just, you know, I'm talking, I'm taking phone calls, and from right where I'm sitting right now, you know, it's crazy. I get people calling in from overseas occasionally, you know, which is flattering as hell, but it's an interesting amalgamation of video, sound, news, the web, and just interested people, you know?
I guess if a congressman's getting upset what you're saying, you know it's getting shared a fair amount of time.
Yeah, that guy doesn't really count. He's an idiot. That Devin Nunes is, yeah, he is exactly, you know, what... He's actually proof that Darwin wasn't right in every case, right? You know,
so, I'm surprised he's not tried to sue you, because I think he's trying to sue a cow on Twitter.
Yeah. That's a crazy thing about the United States, is that we, unlike, you know, Germany, where if you deny the Holocaust or something, they can arrest you. You can say any batshit stupid thing over here, and you're pretty much protected. Although, you know, you'll hear comedians and stuff talk about the cancel culture and stuff. I don't necessarily think that's true. You know, I mean, you followed the controversy with Dave Chappelle recently attacking trans people. I'm like, that's punching down. He's a famous person with a platform. Go after people in power who are oppressing other people. That's what the whole thing was, right? I love Billy Connolly because we worked together 25 years ago or something. And I love that. He said that to me once, you know, about punching up, and I'm not going to try to do a Scottish accent and embarrass myself, but and I remember that too. I was like, that's a really good attitude to have when you're doing comedy. You know, make sure that either you're the butt of the joke or somebody above you is the butt of the joke, not people below you, because that's just too easy and wrong, in my opinion.
I think that's a really good point. Punching up is something that people can do to raise awareness and actually fight for other people. You can use comedy, you can use a platform to fight for others. Think John Mulaney, the comedian from SNL, he talked about this on one of his stand-up shows. You can have comedy in going after certain people or even certain groups, but you should do it from a place of being beneath rather than trying to undermine.
It's hard sometimes with language because, you know, we're in the business of language, right? Mm-hmm. And so it took me a while to come up with terms because I'd get pushback from GLAAD or other gay groups when I would call somebody like a butt pirate. It just sounds funny to me, but they said, no, that has its, you know, derivation and some homophobic thing. So, you know, and I'm an avid golfer. And over the years, I've said that, oh, you know, you're gay because you were short on a putt or something. So, you know, it's good to wake up and understand that. And it, you know, the truth is, it's all just a challenge to be more clever, to be more insightful, you know, to change your language. I am the prototype of white privilege. I used to have long blonde hair. I got blue eyes. I could walk in a room and get anything I want, right? I can walk in a Trump room or I can walk in an Obama room and I'm accepted, right? So with that comes responsibility, you know, a responsibility to speak to power. I mean, especially in my business, you know? So, you know, again, it's been a journey. I've been doing this I've been doing it longer than you've been alive. So that's crazy, right? Because I don't feel that much older than you, but you know, I am a lot. And it's a great awakening sort of thing. And these videos, back to your original question, they'd be nicer if I didn't have to see my mug every day, but, I'd rather put your picture on there, but that's my goal in the next couple of years is to start creating these, and with different actors. I mean, there's a plethora of beautiful people in Southern California that I can find to do these actors and actresses and get them out there and start kind of a channel where I would write and direct these things for these people and help them and do that as well. Because that's, you know, I mean, it's your world coming now, right?
With social media growing and becoming this phenomenal place to share, to reach people, say we can reach people across the world, but it also can be this toxic place a lot of the time. It can lead to a lot of division. And one video you did recently really, I think, emphasized that, because you talked about a new poll that had shown 50% of Trump supporters now absurdly support a civil war, which is just this baffling place that we've got to. How concerned are you about division that we see on social media and that spilling out into real life politics now?
First of all, people are full of shit, okay? People talk about civil war, they have no idea. People talk about war, they have no idea, you know? Remember the boxer Mike Tyson? He used to say everybody's got a plan until somebody hits you in the face, you know? So when these people talk the shit about, you know, separating the country and the war, they've, you know, I mean, without the federal government, Mississippi, Arkansas, Alabama, Georgia, they would disappear. The federal government provides everything they need, from roads to infrastructure to filtration for water to clean air to everything, right? So people who live in the United States have no freaking idea how good they have it. So when they start talking about the libs and, you know, or the flip side around, you know, I mean, it's hard over here to discern a Trump supporter that is, you know, an insane bigot, which I think is a small minority of them, and people that are checkbook Trump supporters. In other words, you know, they thought it would save them in taxes, but that was total bullshit because the small cut they got sunsetted out, where the corporate cut from 35% tax to 21%, he dropped in 2018, that's still there. That doesn't go away. There's no sunset clause. So again, you know, it's the small people, they get deluded by the bullshit and they follow these people. And so they're the ones that will talk about a civil war because they believe, you know, the lie. And of course, the lie is that these rich people don't care about you. How many people from those Trump rallies do you see at Mar-a-Lago? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, someone has to call the king, you know, the emperor naked when he's parading through the streets. And I think that's the media's responsibility. Twitter's given a kind of, there is a responsibility on Twitter. I'm not quite the same, you know. So it doesn't bother me. I don't think it's going to happen. I think that the people that talk about it, they're not going to leave their homes and pick up a gun and go try to hurt somebody. There'll be Proud Boys or some of these racist groups. I'm sure there's the same in the UK, you know. But so no, I'm not worried about it.
We see how people who push for these things or talk about civil wars or how they're going to, you know, fight for this country or whatever. The person they looked up to, the person they elected as president in 2016, let's not forget, used to go and serve when his country asked for it. You see all of these people who talk about it, and you have to ask how many of them would voluntarily fight for their country in a time of war when their country needs them, let alone in some sort of absurd civil war division mindset. But what is this main driver that is pushing people towards this mindset where they say these things? Because even if they don't mean it, there's obviously a division that has emerged online, even if they wouldn't ever engage with it in real life. What do you think is pushing them? Because as you say, if you look at these red states, they need the federal government to support them on infrastructure or provide them with COVID support or any of this farming subsidies. But they have this idea that they want to separate or they want to go against America. What's causing them?
It's like this, Edward. You know, when you stand naked in front of a mirror and you suck in your gut, who are you fooling? It's the mirror. It's you, right? I mean, so Americans tend to do this. We tend to have this vision of ourselves as being the person that stops the Terminator, and you know, this where we're still, you know, we're fat and out of shape, and we watch too much TV. You know, so we get these grandiose ideas about change and what we want to happen. And if they got close enough, anybody that gets close enough to these political issues or these social political issues, starts to realize the truth that it's much more complicated than it seems when you read a 280 characters in Twitter, right? I mean, it is. It's much more complicated. And that's the key, you know. It's like if there's an anti-abortion person out there that wants to go out and hand out condoms, I'm with you, buddy. Let's go. Let's work on a solution instead of beating the shit out of each other. And at the end of the day, you know, if you make that kind of approach to people, and I think that, you know, they can understand. So I think so much of that is, I just finished a book. It's going to come out about talk radio. It's called Speed Bumps and Guns. And that shows you the types of stories we do. A speed bump story is a local story, right? It's a story that affects us all, you know, like, oh, they're going to start collecting trash an hour earlier and it's going to wake me up. Or there's somebody breaking into cars in the neighborhood. That slowly moves into a gun story, which is a story that affects your security. It could be vaccines or it could be, you know, Eastern Europe coming over the border or, you know, whenever time in history, France, you know, Germany, whatever. So those two stories are what really gets people to follow the news. You've seen it over here in America a lot on our news. At the end of every newscast, we put a little feel-good story, because we just beat the shit out of you for 21 and a half minutes. So we'll put a 30-second story about a little cat that gets lost and they find him in 10 miles away, you know, or what, how should I say that? at 20 clicks. Anyway, the point is that, you know, there's money in scaring people, right? There's not as much money in comforting people. But I don't know, man. You know, during a pandemic, I think people found a new inspiration and the irony of course, of having to have 700,000 Americans die is people began to realize, oh, you know, life's a little more precious than I thought, you know?
The money in scaring people, the way to attract people is by presenting them with things either that anger them, scare them, they might disagree with, and so they feel enraged, feel like they have to engage with that content. We see that with what Facebook's been accused of doing. They were accused of engaging deliberately to antagonize people. And we've seen in America, the media in the form of Fox News, OAN, that push these ideas, deliberately twist things in order to anger, enrage their audience or to play into their audience's fears. You go back to before the 2018 midterms, for example, Fox News ran with this whole story about the migrant caravan, and there's a migrant caravan coming to America and they're going to overwhelm the border. And they played this up. And then sure enough, as soon as the election was over, as soon as they didn't need to enrage people on this issue, never talked about it again, because they're playing into these ideas of fears. And I find this really fascinating from a British perspective, looking in on America, when you have networks that can do that. You've appeared on Fox News. You've actually been into the bear pit of Fox News. And it's a platform that many people who aren't of that political persuasion refused to go on because of the way things are twisted. Why did you choose to go on, and sort of how did you find that experience and the aftermath of it? Because that media is fascinating for people looking in on America.
I love to compete. You know, I love to, and especially with ideas. Some are more fun than others. I feel bad. I'm on my Twitter page, the very first page, I'm on this thing called Fox Morning News on a Sunday morning. And it was the day that Trump was in Hawaii, and the USS John McCain, who was a United States Senator, who was kind of a war hero of sorts. Real quickly, the reason he was a war hero was his father was an admiral and he was in a POW camp. He'd been there 3 years, and they told him he could go home after 3 years of living in a box, essentially, right? With people beating him, broken bones. And he said, no, there's a guy here that's been here longer than me. He goes before I do. That's the kind of person John McCain was, right? I didn't agree with his economic policies and everything, but you can't help but say, you know, that's a decent son of a bitch right there, right? So his ship was in Hawaii. And the Trump people, because Trump hated McCain so much because McCain stood up to him, they covered the name of the USS John McCain so Trump wouldn't see it. So when I heard that, I was on the show that morning on Fox. It's the last time I've been on Fox. I got banned after this. They were talking. He was the guy, the other guy's a guy from LA, just this asshole. We were talking and they were talking about McCain. So at that point, I just held up a picture of John McCain in front of my face. So, cause I know it's like a panel of three faces. And I got so much shit from that, but also so much good stuff. You know, Meghan McCain reached out, a bunch of other people did. It made me feel really good. So I'm going on those shows. I plan carefully. For example, I'm doing this from a studio right now in my home, but back then I would go into a studio and I have an idea what they would ask me, but I wanted to really use facts and statistics. So I would take them and I would put them around the camera lens. So while I'm looking at you like this and I'm talking, I'm actually reading the statistics. So for example, on that one, we're talking immigration. And I'll say, did you know, first of all, first generation Americans commit crimes at a higher rate than immigrants, right? Sanctuary cities reduce crime in those cities because people feel comfortable calling the cops knowing they won't get deported. Also, the people that come into this country from Central America have a higher rate of vaccination than people in Texas and Louisiana. So I would know all these statistics about it. And by the way, the United States is dead without immigration. We're not producing enough babies to continue to give the social services that we offer, which is essentially everything. I love when people say, and we don't want to be socialist. I go, too late, dude. That train has left the station. We are socialist in every possible way you can be socialist. So I go on these shows and I just, I know the argument because I started out as kind of conservative. So I know it. And I've realized what bullshit trickle down theory was. It doesn't happen. It doesn't trickle. You know, you give tax breaks to corporations and they send the money, they park it in Ireland or wherever they can not pay taxes. And, you know, Apple's a great example. They got like $500 billion in banks around the world and they're not paying taxes on that. Jeff Bezos, we know the story from Amazon. So, yeah, I mean, I can go on these shows and my whole point of going on the shows is, you know, it's a puppet giant you're praying to. This idea of, you know, the United States needs to have this unfettered economic free-for-all. That, you know, it's bullshit. It hurts poor people. So a long answer to, you know, why I go on these shows. I go on there so I can talk to these other people. You know, I mean, I try not to be too adversarial. I try to be, you know, I mean, I'll make a joke or two or something like that, which will piss them off. But, you know, I just try to talk to the other side.
Do you find that proves effective a lot of the time? Because there are people who say that going on these shows just helps boost those networks, boost those channels and so on, because it gives them a sparring partner for the person they want to promote the voice of. It gives them a way to play into a narrative by really doubling down on it. Do you find that you do reach out, you know, after that appearance, for example, on Fox News, did you find that you got response from people who wouldn't have otherwise seen your content because they live in that Fox News, that potentially right-wing bubble, that might have been swayed by your comments that they might have thought this is actually a thing to address?
I would be tremendously overestimating my abilities to think that I could change somebody's opinion. You know, it's just like, it's like a morning shower. It doesn't really change the water supply, but it's a little helpful and maybe reminds people, you know, that shit does come from the sky. I don't know. It makes me sad sometimes when I hear people that support Trump, you know, that I like, you know, and it's not just Trump, but it's that whole populist movement, you know, the idea that, you know, I mean, democracy is really just mob rule. You know, we live in a republic. We elect people to make these decisions. Pure democracy is, you know, people, a large crowd of people coming into a small area and taking them over. I mean, that's democracy. It's not as beautiful as it sounds. So talking to these people and trying to give them an idea of, you know, just go back and read what Alexander Hamilton wrote. Go read, you know, John Locke. You know, we stole these ideas from the Greeks and from England. You know, I mean, these are just a compilation of great ideas through human history that we have. And, you know, I'm just trying to, I would love it if they would just, you know, just go watch Harold Maud. I mean, you can't not watch that movie and be changed, you know. Read Guns, Germs, and Steel, about the evolution of the human being over the last 13,000 years. Pulitzer Prize winning book. And it, you know, it's not hard to read. I mean, it's not like you don't have to be highly educated. Otherwise, I couldn't read them, you know. Going through these books and you know, beginning to understand our place in the world, you know. I mean, like it or not, we now see the images from Darfur. Have to make decisions. You know, we saw what happened in Afghanistan after 20 years of fucking that up and had to leave, you know, and what would happen if we'd spent the last 20 years building hospitals, bridges, and roads instead of selling arms to Saudi Arabia so they can bomb women and children in Yemen in the middle of a civil war and a drought? How would our image be changed around the world? It'd be fucking huge. I mean, that's the kind of shit that, you know, I go on these shows. I want to say, why do we want to bomb a fucking refugee camp in Nepal or wherever the fuck it is? You know, that's why I go on those shows. And yeah, it does. But I'm not, you know, you can make that case about Obama and giving a, you know, OAN legitimacy if he should go on that show, or some, you know, U.S. senator. And OAN is, of course, an abortion of a network. But, you know, I think it's good to go on those things. It's good to talk to people.
You mentioned something that I find really interesting, which is about the way that in politics, for example, America does things where it'll sell arms to Saudi Arabia to use in Yemen or things like that. The US has a $700 billion defense budget, but yet at the same time says, how are we going to pay for a Green New Deal? How are we going to pay for housing? How are we going to pay for infrastructure? How are we going to stop schools literally falling apart or roads collapsing in America? And there's just this weird debate that often happens where people go, oh yeah, but we need this military, we need this to defend ourselves.
Have you ever seen that from Newsroom with Jeff Daniels, that scene? Yes. So classic. Yeah, that's so true too.
Fantastic speech. But that sort of approach, how have we got onto this place where in politics to suggest these helpful policies that people believe and would, scientists agree, experts in those fields agree, would make differences, would really improve people's lives. Have we got to this place where people, you know, will just scream, for example, socialist at you? You know, if you said, I support a Green New Deal, people would accuse you of being socialist. If you support the infrastructure bill, people claim that's some socialist attempt to fund various policies, neither of which they are. How have we got to this place, do you think, where that's the political debate that we're having, rather than actually talking about the issues, rather than going in depth like people once would have done, had serious policy discussions?
It's a great point. I mean, you know, Socratic dialogue is so important to teach young people. You know, the yeah, it's funny. I there was a book called 1L when I was a kid. It was written by a guy named Scott Turow. It's about his first year at Harvard Law School. And you'd come into class and the professor might ask you a question. If you don't know the answer, he would keep asking questions and belittle you. It was this Socratic approach to prove that, you know, you have to have a sound base of understanding moving forward. And that's what I think that we lack over here. We stopped teaching critical skills, critical thinking skills to young people. And how to evaluate, you know, I mean, remember those thought experiments we had as kids, you know, in a, I remember Einstein used to have just, he would sit around trying to come up with these all the time and working on relativity and looking at social policy, it's really not that much different, you know, how important is it for us to have this military? And if instead we worked with developing nations, that, you know, I mean, look at China and you look at Putin, right? And neither one of them don't want to start a nuclear war because, you know, China especially, you know, they're making money. Why would you do that, right? Kim Jong-un, I don't know what he's capable of, but for the most part, the rest of the world has their own self-interest, which war always plays against. So, you know, we build up this military and you look at this budget and so much of that is inflated. You know, if it's $700 billion, you know, I mean, I've heard estimates we could get this thing done for $300 billion, right? But you have in place, as Eisenhower said, the military-industrial complex. You know, you have, it reminds me sometimes of that famous Churchill quote about Americans, after exhausting all the other possibilities, always do the right thing, you know? And it's true, you know, we because we're so big and we have so many voices, it takes a while for the truth to kind of make its way to the surface, but it always will, you know, and the truth is that if in fact we represent, you know, all these people, we have to care to their needs. You know, yeah, we have to defend our borders, but as Mark Twain said, the Pacific Ocean and Atlantic Ocean protect us pretty damn well, and they have the last 250 years, right? So yeah, do we need submarines going around the world with nuclear missiles in them? I don't know. I can't tell you, you know, the state of that. You know, I'm sure it does give pause to, you know, to Xi or Putin or others that might be ever thinking about an aggressive attack against us or allies. But do we need to spend all that money for that? And, you know, and can we just tell the American people and tell the world, you know, I mean, we have what percentage of the world goes to bed hungry every night? You know, I mean, that's the kind of thinking that, you know, I'm a agnostic or atheist or whatever you want to call it, but I do believe in that there is a ghost in the machine when a group of people get together and they want to make something happen, whatever it is, you know, that makes us hug a complete stranger at a football match when our team wins, right? A person of a different color or race, you know, we bond in that moment. So I love that magic of that. That's what I love about sports. You know, because we can erase all this other bullshit, you know. So again, going back to, you know, the money that we spend in the United States and how the world looks at this, it's a nuanced discussion. And we don't have nuanced conversations anymore. It's all you're on this side, I'm on this side. And, you know, the ability to kind of back to your Fox question by going on their show, we need a nuanced conversation, but it is, you know, Trump was incapable. You know, I mean, a lot of people look at nuance as being weak. I'm sure you know people like that, you know. It's like, you know, this is us. This is who we stand for. Anything else, you know, and eventually that just doesn't hold up.
we're seeing people are being taught now, unfortunately, from the way that things are shown on media, from the way that some politicians act. People are being taught that it's more admirable to stand firm on a position rather than actually, as you say, take that nuanced approach or have a serious discussion. You know, people are seen as weak for being nuanced. I think there's a strong argument for that's part of the downfall of this ability to have serious debates, because people are taught that they have to be one way or the other. In the UK, you either have to be an ardent Brexit supporter, or you have to be an ardent Remain supporter.
So somewhere in between that, somebody combs Boris Johnson's hair, right? Yeah. I mean, between...
Then in America, you've got these ardent MAGA supporters, and or you have to be some sort of far left. People are being taught that there's no place for this centrist middle ground, consider the options thing that we used to have in politics. This idea that politics used to be played on the center ground and is now being played on the wings, really. Do you think this part down to you see that, say, the media play up this idea of division? You'll find that a segment is the one you were in, they'll find two people who vehemently disagree and there's a host in the middle. Or in politics, you see that instead of the coverage being about a serious debate that went on in politics, it was about how Matt Gaetz went and wore a gas mask to make an absurd stunt about mask wearing, or instead of discussing a serious... Do you think we're getting to this place now where just because those are played up, it's just, it really is defeating that actual ability to have a sensible, serious conversation, debate about issues and actually get somewhere, because we're losing that?
I think everybody's learning on the run about, you know, all the information we can have and trying to triage what's important. I mean, we have as much as you could possibly, you know, you could fathom. I mean, when I was your age, you know, there was none of this shit existed, you know, and it was interesting, you know, the watching the process of digitizing, you know, all this information and putting it in. I don't really know. If vaccine is a great example, right? So people, first of all, vaccine, you know, I've heard this many times about immunity. Vaccines don't give you immunity. They help your body fight. They're an ally. You know, they teach your body how to fight is what they do. And so I try to start with that with people, you know, that you have, when you get sick from a particular bug and that same bug is around, you're not going to get sick again because your body has learned how to fight it. You know, whatever strain of flu you get, if I get the flu and then I give it to somebody in my family 2 weeks later, I'm not going to get the flu from them because I had that flu and my body can fight it. That's what a vaccine does. It's a way. It's not any more artificial than, wearing clothes. You know, I mean, it's a construct that helps you protect yourself and move forward. We've had variations of vaccines for 250 years. I mean, we've known about this, you know, that it works. And that's what I try to tell people. I try to teach people that used to work with cows would get cowpox from a cow, and it would make them less susceptible to smallpox to a certain degree, because there were, you know, parts of it that were similar. So I try to break it down for people when I talk to people now, you know, and get away from all the hyperbole. You know, I try to just talk to people about science, try to talk to them about, you know, issues that seem so complicated, so difficult to grasp. And on a public policy level, they are. But on the street, you know, trying to talk to people, you don't want to kill your grandma, right? Your grandma can't get this virus. So if you get the vaccine, you know, there'll be a less chance that you'll be the person that infects her. Because, you know, and we had a point here where the lieutenant governor of Texas was in the early days of the pandemic was telling old people to go out and get sick and die and get out of the way. I mean, it was just horrible, but I don't think he was a horrible person. I just think he was dumb as fuck, you know, and that's it. And that's difficult. Dumb as fuck is a hard place to beat. You know, it's hard to get to those people because they're, you know, dumb is a synonym for fear, you know, so getting through all that. So you know, human beings, we get through it all. You know, I mean, we're all the same. I studied martial arts when I was a kid, and I used to have this real, I used to put the Japanese culture on such a high pedestal about honor and everything. And then I started reading about how that, you know, when they felt dishonored, they would, through a practice called seppuku, they would cut open and let their bowels, you know, they cut right across their stomach, and their bowels would drop on the floor. And I'm like, I think that's a little much. You could have said, I'm sorry, maybe 100 times instead of doing that. Is that really necessary? You know? So, I mean, there's, you know, you kind of go through these cultures and you go, okay, yeah, I get it, but that's probably too much, you know? So, I mean, yeah, I think we're learning and getting better through all this, do all this shit. You know, I think we're learning, you know, when you make a mistake, be a little smarter, right? So, I mean, we make a lot of mistakes the last 30 years to the beginning of this whole world. And of course, the world's on fire, too. So there's climate change and all that other stuff that affects us all that we can, you know, but some people don't believe that. You have to break that down, you know. So maybe the real challenge for all of us and for you moving forward is finding ways to, metaphors and analogies are wonderful tools, you know, when used well, because throughout human history, we've used storytelling to try to, you know, get across these complex, you know, an inconvenient truth was a great bit of storytelling by Al Gore, right, about climate change. And we have to keep doing that. We have to find ways, you know, to try to take these complex things and I don't say dumb them down, just tell a better story, you know, for people so they can understand it and bring them into your camp that way instead of beating them over the head.
Before we do, are you allowed to mention the book?
It hasn't been printed yet, but it's called Speed Bumps and Guns. And if they follow me on Twitter, they'll hear about it, @ChipFranklin. You know, they can do that. That's the easiest way. And I have most of my videos are there. I got some at chipfranklin.com, and which, you know, go. I mean, I'm like vomit after nobody cleans up after 2 days. You can find me all over the place. It's like kind of the smell goes everywhere. So, there's lots out there that people can see. But the book, I like the book. I mean, it's about 400 pages, but it goes through a chronological. I was there. I was one of the people at the beginning of talk radio. I started doing talk radio in 93. There was no internet. There was really little any cable. I would have to get newspapers and bring them up. But I was, you know, I was working and they gave me a radio show in Washington, D.C. in the middle of the early part of the 90s from 3 or 4 hours at night. I had no idea what the hell I was doing. Right. And I kind of learned. But I that's why I started out kind of conservative, because the only people on radio were conservative and I would listen to them, you know. But I was always, you know, I was always pro gay and pro choice and all these issues. But, you know, I really believed. You know, that, and this is what the book's about. You know, conservative talk radio today is about finding something wrong and then finding someone to blame. But talk radio started out as a way for people to communicate and somehow turned into the shouting match. And that's, you know, and now, of course, the algorithms just funnel more of the same shit to people all the time. And so this is kind of what my experience has been in it, you know. So I'd probably be do it for until they fire me for a couple more years anyway. So the book is about those stories, about how does somebody end up doing that for a job for that long, talking into this thing for 3 hours a day and people actually listen to them. It's crazy, you know?
Well, I guess that being a talk radio host back when you started it was a very different world. You mentioned about John McCain earlier. John McCain as a conservative would probably be rolling in his grave at the thoughts that his version of conservatism was being compared to what today's version of the Republican conservatives is. And I imagine the same with you.
I read The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith in like right after 9/11. And I found it interesting, you know, the idea of the invisible hand always will, you know, go in there and protect people. But nobody told me before he wrote that book, he wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And I went and I read that, and it totally contradicted the theory of trickle-down economics, this right-wing sort of idea. And he said, if you don't have a safety net in there, if you don't look out after people, then the whole thing will collapse. You'll get a revolution, and it will feed on that. And why don't we talk about that book more instead of shit, 99% of the people listening now have never read or heard of John Maynard Keynes or Adam Smith. But those two people represent the basic, you know, different views of government and its role in our lives. And it's a good place to, you know, ask yourself, if you're just listening today, what if I could design a government, you know, put that on yourself, pretend you're, you know, if you're an American listening, you know, look back and say, you know, what would I have done different than John Jay or Hamilton or Madison, you know, in the middle of this, this revolution, this thing, you know, with you guys, right? I mean, and the British government, you know, King George, you know, is Trump and are Trump and King George really any different? Hell no. I would say to I think, you know, King George would say, I want nothing to do with that guy, you know? And you know, British royalty and the idea we laugh at you guys, you know, at your kings and queens and, you know, all that. But shit, we have the exact same thing over here. We just call it something else. You know, Calvinism, the idea over here that people are born into something and that they shouldn't try to leave their social strata. All that bullshit. It's exactly what we fought against 250 years ago. And we're doing it ourselves today, which makes sense. That's human nature. You kind of fall back to things that give you comfort. And that's the irony, is that people who we beat the shit out of are comforted by beating the shit up because we've told them that it's God's way or this is their role. And they buy that shit, you know, I mean, for a while.
We always forget America is only a few hundred years old and has plenty of ability to grow and change and develop. And that was what it was always supposed to be. You look at the founding fathers, they never intended for what they wrote and the way they directed America back then to be, this is fixed, this is exactly what's supposed to be. America is a changing nation and can continue to do that, certainly. And people can always look to build and grow.
Look at our biggest allies. Our biggest allies, we had the biggest wars of our nation, England, Japan, Germany, and now we're close friends. I mean, and shit, we dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan and they're still our friends. I mean, a lot of things can happen. I mean, you know, it's like this. I used to think that a cynic was a skeptic with all the facts, but now I think an optimist is a cynic with children. When you have kids, how can you be anything but optimistic? How can you not think about, you know, these issues that face us that, you know, that your generation, you know, I have a son your age, you know, what am I doing to make that next world better for them other than trying to save money for them? That's bullshit. Right? What am I doing, you know, so that when they speak of me, they go, you know, Dad said this, what about this? Or, you know, Franklin said this. And, you know, I would hope that would be the lesson that people have. Again, it's like that morning shower that you come out. It's not a heavy rain, but it was nice. It's nice. It gives something to the day. It's a little bit of life, a little bit of reminder. You know, and I, you know, so I kind of look for, God, I sound like an old man. I kind of look for those things now, you know, and doing this and talking to people, you know, such as yourself. And, you know, that's why I love to do these interviews. I talk way too much, but I enjoy, you know, what you have to say and your points of view.
Chip Franklin, thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you. Stay in touch.
That was Chip Franklin. Radio host on KGO Radio, comedian, musician, and you'll find his regular coverage of current affairs on Really American and InsideTheBeltway.com. That's all for today's episode. What did you think about that interview? Let me know on Twitter at Edward T. Hardy. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating and subscribe, or recommend this podcast by submitting a review online and sharing it with friends and family. Until next time, goodbye.